After 9/11, President Bush issued a fundamental change to U.S. strategy, embracing the concept of preemptive war to remove what he described as gathering threats. It's a concept many would say was repudiated in the last election, but Andrew Bacevich argues that the new president has yet to articulate a new national strategy. As we pass the sober milestone of 5,000 American dead in Iraq and Afghanistan and approach the 8th anniversary of 9/11, what are the big questions we need to ask about when and where the country will use force, and what are the vital interests for which we will fight? We'd especially like to hear from listeners in or recently out of uniform today. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Joining us now, retired Army Colonel Andrew Bacevich, professor of history and international relations at Boston University. His op-ed, Obama's Strategic Blind Spot, recently appeared in the Los Angeles Times. He's with us today from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
And you say that when we talk so much about Iraq and Afghanistan in recent years, talking about the surges in both those countries, we're talking about operations and tactics and not about strategy.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the president gives every evidence of being a pragmatist, somebody who deals in the real world. That's a good thing. That's an improvement over what we had when we had an administration that tended to ignore reality. But the argument I try to make in that short piece is that pragmatism needs to be informed by some larger vision, purpose, strategy, if you will. And at least I have not seen that strategy articulated either by the president or by anybody else in his administration up to this point.
The surge, as you describe it, for Afghanistan cannot come as a surprise. He campaigned on that and has thus far stuck reasonably closely to his timetable to draw down American forces in Iraq.
Yeah, but if you put those two wars in the context of if you identify them as theaters in the so-called long war, really what the president is doing is attempting to shut down one theater. We'll see if he's able to do that at the same time that he ratchets things up in another theater. I mean, I understand the argument for doing that, but why exactly is it necessary for the United States to engage in really perpetual war? I mean, I am struck. Here we are in the summer of Michael Jackson and Sonia Sotomayor and Walter Cronkite. We have become a people that for all practical purposes accepts the reality that we are going to be engaged in war from now until the cows come home. And it seems to me that we ought not to accept that without having somebody demonstrate that perpetual war is an imperative and that there is no alternative.
So the overarching principles of, to borrow a phrase from many years ago, of why we fight.
Exactly right. And I mean, to my mind, there have been no over. I mean, the one thing you could say for the Bush administration is that for all their fantasies, they did articulate a vision for what the long war was supposed to accomplish. And they imagined that through the use of American hard power, we could undertake some grand transformation of the Islamic world, bring about peace, democracy, stability, and the like. It was a foolish vision, but it was a vision. And I'm simply arguing that the president owes it to us to provide an alternative vision and to explain why the expenditure of lives and treasure in places like Afghanistan contributes to some larger purpose. And he hasn't given us that statement yet.
The idea that, the last time we left Afghanistan to its own devices, a group grew there and was harbored there that attacked this country, that in itself is not enough reason?
I must say it's not for me, and I understand clearly that mine is a minority voice here. I mean, the argument is that 9/11 happened because we ignored Afghanistan. Therefore, to prevent another 9/11, we have to transform, we have to fix Afghanistan. My argument is, well, that misses, I think, a much more immediate explanation for 9/11. The reason 9/11 happened is because we didn't defend ourselves adequately. I mean, the federal, state, and local agencies who were responsible for aviation security didn't undertake even minimally adequate measures that would keep 19 thugs with box cutters from perpetrating that. So one of my principles that I would like to see be at the foundation of our strategy is that we will defend the country by defending the country, rather than imagining that the defense of the country requires this projection of American power in far-off, landlocked, undeveloped countries like Afghanistan, remembering that here in this particular moment in our history, it's not as if we have a lot of sort of spare change and spare soldiers laying around. In fact, the limits of American power have been clearly, demonstrated by the events of the last 3 or 4 years. And recognizing limits means that we ought to consider alternative courses of action. And a president who was elected because he promised to change the way Washington works, seems to me that the change ought to extend to considering the possibility of changing the assumed fundamentals of U.S. national security policy.
This is known in terms of art as strategic doctrine, and we saw some manifestations of it just this week. Vice President Biden has been on a tour in Eastern Europe and said again to Ukraine that the United States supports Ukraine's entry into the NATO alliance, and was in Georgia today, the country that fought a brief war with Russian and Russian allied forces just a year ago, and said that the United States will stand by Georgia.
Yeah, well, that's certainly not changing the way Washington works, because that really reflects a perpetuation of a policy of eastward expansion of NATO that we've undertaken since the end of the Cold War. Now, let me be clear. The eastward expansion of NATO at Russia's expense certainly made sense to a degree. It certainly succeeded in incorporating fully into Europe the countries of so-called Eastern Europe that used to be part of the old Soviet Empire. But we've long since passed the point of diminishing returns in that regard, and it really makes very little sense for us to keep poking the Russian bear in the eye on these matters, intruding into what the Russians see as their sphere of influence, especially given the fact that the Obama administration sees Russian assistance as increasingly vital in order to sustain the Afghanistan war. So there just seems to me to be lacking some overarching or integrated sense of purpose that is animating the various initiatives of this administration. As I said in the piece, I mean, I'm as an outside observer, which is all I am, it really seems to me that the strategy portfolio is unassigned. The president's got czars in the White House for about 15 different various and sundry issues. There is no strategy czar, and there needs to be, and it probably needs to be him.
One of the things that you write in the piece is, in terms of your proposal for these principles, ought to include no more crusades unless the American people buy in. They are expecting a relative handful of soldiers to carry the load while the rest of the country binges on consumption is, you say, unconscionable.
I mean, I think it's truly immoral. We proclaim our desire to support the troops. But I guess I'm in the camp that thinks that those words ring hollow when supporting the troops neglects to include a considered examination of whether the wars in which the troops are engaged are genuinely necessary. And when we pay for those wars, as we have been paying for both the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, not by making sacrifices ourselves, but basically by plunging the country ever deeper in debt on the assumption that some future generation is going to have to figure out how to pay the bills. I think that's wrong.
Our guest is Andrew Bacevich, a retired colonel and the author of The Long War, A New History of U.S. National Security Policy Since World War II. And let's get some callers on the line, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Vitus is calling from Tucson.
Hi. I'd like to comment that I think the way to fight these international terrorists is through law enforcement means and through small covert ops, and that every time we use conventional arms and cause civilian casualties, we're perpetuating the problem because people in these countries have a longstanding culture of retribution and revenge, and the more we use things like drones to strike and often kill innocent people, we're just recruiting more people to fight in the future.
Andrew Bacevich?
I couldn't agree more. I mean, in the wake of 9/11, the perpetrators of the so-called global war on terror argued that 9/11 had completely discredited the law enforcement approach to dealing with the problem of terrorism, and basically charged that anybody who argued to the contrary was somehow, weak on national security. That argument really never had any merit to it. We failed. Where we failed in 9/11 and where we have failed since is in effectively taking a law enforcement approach to dealing with the problem of violent radicalism. And the caller, I think, is exactly right. There's plenty of evidence suggesting that a big American footprint and the American tendency to rely on firepower, which tends, inevitably to cause noncombatant casualties, that this then simply contributes to a backlash and plays into the hands of the jihadists.
Vitus, thanks very much for the phone call. We're talking about U.S. national strategy or strategic doctrine with Andrew Bacevich. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go next to John. John calling from Richmond, Virginia.
Yes, sir. I'd like to agree with the officer that the foreign projection of U.S. military power does nothing to protect the United States. When vets return in very poor psychological condition and they want to be police, it can make it much more dangerous in the American streets. And also I'd like to make the point that when an event like 9/11 arises, a lot of bizarre conspiracy theories arise. And the craziest one I've heard yet is that it was engineered and perpetrated by 19 Arab hijackers with box cutters.
I'm afraid that's not so much a conspiracy theory. I guess it is a conspiracy theory, but the conspiracy has been more than proven. In any case, Andrew Bacevich, the point about U.S. military power abroad not protecting the United States, it does protect U.S. interests. There are things like the Fifth Fleet in the Persian Gulf based in Bahrain that is described by a lot of people as part of the strategic architecture of American forces around the world that's going to be permanent, that's going to stay there no matter what happens.
You know, it's not a question of either all in or all out, it seems to me. I mean, one of the things that I would want an Obama strategic vision to do would be to discriminate between those commitments that we've made that continue to have value, utility, and other commitments that perhaps have outlived their value and utility and therefore should be scrapped. The rhetoric of American statecraft, with its emphasis on global leadership and indispensable nation and world's only superpower and the like, obstructs efforts to discriminate in that way and to make wise choices about where American global commitments make sense and where American global commitments can be perhaps withdrawn.
And this is not just about an explanation for why the goal in Iraq and Afghanistan, why we are pursuing those conflicts or not, but about what would happen, why we do or do not get involved in Somalia or Iran or North Korea.
Or why we're still in NATO 60 years after the end of World War II and a couple decades after the end of the Cold War. I mean, Europe is fully capable of defending itself against the relatively modest security threats that they face. So let the Europeans manage their own affairs. It's a stable place. It's a democratic place. It's a place where liberal values flourish. We've got bigger fish to fry. And I'd want to emphasize, we have bigger fish to fry here at home. I mean, in that short LA Times piece, one of the principles I was suggesting is that perhaps the way to promote the spread of freedom and democracy around the world should de-emphasize effort to sort of shove it down people's throats and place greater emphasis on modeling what freedom and democracy look like and what a society animated by liberal values looks like. We have lots of work to be done here at home in order to be that kind of a positive model. And when resources are constrained, as they are, it seems to me that's when you have to make some choices.
And how urgent is this need to articulate this overarching idea, this strategic doctrine?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, again, I am encouraged by the fact that this is an administration which is not likely to go off half-cocked the way the Bush administration did. But nonetheless, it seems to me that over time it will become increasingly difficult simply to manage foreign policy based on whatever happens to be the issue that gets to the top of the inbox. You know, last week, Secretary of State Clinton gave a speech at the Council on Foreign Relations, and I think the speech was touted as, you know, her first big statement of foreign policy. And to my mind, at least, you take a look at that, and it's nothing but a bunch of empty cliches. I mean, she concludes by quote from Tom Paine about we have it in our power to begin the world all over again, and basically said, yep, we sure do, and we're going to go begin the world. I mean, that's ridiculous. And it's not worthy of her.
Andrew Bacevich, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Andrew Bacevich, a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. His op-ed, Obama's Strategic Blind Spot, recently appeared in the Los Angeles Times. He joined us from member station WBUR in Boston. Tomorrow, I'll be away. Lynn Neary will be here. What's the teen classic you reread? Plus, ask Amy on the pitfalls of college roommates. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan.